This is Clusterfucked. Here's your host, Roger King.
Welcome to another edition of Clusterfucked. This is Roger King. I've been looking forward to today's show because my guest also spends his time encouraging Americans to move to different states. Now, on this show, of course, we make the case for liberals to start spreading out more and to move to conservative states. But my guest today, he also gets people to move from blue states to red, but he's working on getting conservatives to move. And in fact, his company's called Conservative Move, and it's a real estate company based in Texas, finding homes for conservatives who just can't take it anymore living around liberals. Paul Chabot is the founder of Conservative Move, and he joins us today. Paul, welcome to Clusterfucked.
Hey, Roger, great to be with you and your listeners today.
I'm afraid I'm not going to be very original. I'm sure I'm going to ask you the question that you probably always get asked. Take us through how this company came to be. What made you decide to do this?
Yeah, sure. And before I get there, I want to say, yeah, I appreciate this conversation. I think that, you know, having a liberal and a conservative having a conversation is good, especially if we always have the goal in mind, the same goals. And yeah, I'm sure you and I want what's best for America. We might just have different ways of how we think we get there. And so I always love a respectful conversation. Unfortunately, you know, that might not always happen out there in society. So maybe this could be a good lesson learned. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the sentiment, and I'm all for a civility as well. And you know, I think it can be done, and I'm feeling optimistic already. So
here's sort of the theory or behind you know, our business. My wife and I were born and raised in California. I went to school there, undergrad, graduate school, USC, lived in L.A., lived in Santa Monica, Rancho Cucamonga, Riverside. Went to the beach a lot as a kid, snowboarding in the mountains. I was not raised political by any stretch. In fact, my first vote when I was 18, I was in college freshman, and I voted for Ross Perot. I couldn't really tell you I knew much about Republicans, Democrats, but what I liked about him was that he loved America, and he really talked about supporting our country and our businesses, and I just thought that was something that attached to me. I evolved into a Republican, but more so evolved into a conservative over time based on my own life experience. I went through drug rehab when I was 12. I've been working with addicts now. Gosh, I'm 44, so I've been working with addicts ever since I was 12. I went into law enforcement, became a reserve deputy sheriff out of San Bernardino County, did 21 years, retired. I was not a kid who liked cops. I grew up hating the police. They took my dad to jail. I blamed it for splitting up our family as a young kid. So then to evolve and become a police officer working narcotics was a real eye-opening experience for me. And then 18 years in the military, currently still serve as a reservist. And so I take these life experiences, that of military, law enforcement, being a dad, that has helped me with a foundation of seeing what I think is best for America and our communities. I always approach life through the same lens, and that is, what kind of community do we want to see children raised in? And so me, having grown up in a broken home, drugs, gangs, running away from home, and looking at today, society where one out of five kids in our public schools are using an illicit drug, high divorce rate, lack of morals and standards, not many role models out there, I fall back on who I am, and that comes to the values of conservatism. So why then did we create this business, and how in the world did I end up in Texas?
Before you answer that question, I mean, of course, you know, quite a fascinating background you just gave there, you know, a tiny bit to unpack. I don't want to, you know, dive too deep into it, but how did it come to be that you were even around, you know, drugs or anything at such a young age?
You know, it's I've got four kids. My oldest daughter is at the age of when I started first using, and I look at her and go, my gosh, I was that young. But here's a fact, you know, 10% of all those who end up going on in life using harder drugs and becoming addicts actually start out in the seventh grade. And that's when I started. Very easy access as a kid, and I had my own paper route. In fact, I had three paper routes. And so I had access to cash, I had access to friends, I had access to alcohol, access to marijuana. marijuana and began to get in a lot of trouble as a kid, along with all the other kids that I was hanging out with. So that was sort of my evolution. I about a good year and a half of using, starting off experimenting to using every single day, not going to school, watching my life go down a path when at that age I didn't think it was too bad of a problem. My mom saw some issues with me growing up, and she put me in the back of a car, drove me to a juvenile hall facility, showed me the walls around that place, and then drove me to a youth drug rehabilitation program and basically gave me a choice. And happily ever after. You know, unfortunately, 90% of those who end up in treatment don't quite make it. There's a high relapse rate. But my gosh, that's probably another day for another whole show.
Yeah, but you know what? I mean, I'm sorry to hear that you had that experience so young, but at the same time, obviously you're through it and well-adjusted, and I didn't know we were going to go in that direction off the top, but, I'm happy to hear, life has turned around, needless to say, for you. Take us back to the company.
So I ran for Congress twice out in California as a Republican, won the Republican nomination, but handily defeated by the Democrat in the second election. While I was running, an article popped up on my computer about best places in America to raise a family. And in 2013 or 14, when I read this on my computer, the city that popped up was named McKinney in Texas. Never heard of it, never been to Texas except for change in planes in DFW. And I made a detour flying across country, extra layover in Dallas to explore McKinney. And I drove around just in awe about how beautiful it was. There was no trash, no graffiti, no homeless shelters. I began to look at the schools and researched that they had a 98.2% graduation rate and the economy was thriving, and went back home and talked to my wife and said this would be a great place to consider for a backup plan. If all efforts here in California of us trying to improve it fail, then we've got an escape route. So I lost in 2016 for the congressional race, and we packed up 4 kids, dog, drove halfway across country here to Texas. And once we moved here, we had no idea we were going to create a company called Conservative Move. But when we moved here, we realized so many people were from California or New York or New Jersey or other blue states who moved for the exact same reasons that we did. And that's when the light bulb came on. You know, why don't we create a company that helps families move out of blue states into red states? So we line them up with real estate agents to help them sell their home in the blue state, help them buy a home in a red state. But we also go beyond that. We also help them find employment. We've got a national recruiter. And then once they move into the states, we encourage them to get involved with local politics, local Republican Party, local initiatives, so that the reasons they're moving to the states they're going to don't trend into the states that they just left, if that makes sense.
No, I get it. And it just took off, right? I mean, as you said, it's only been a couple of years since you made the move, let alone started the company.
Yeah, it blew up overnight. First my local paper in California picked up the story, and then public radio, and then from there just went to Fox, to CNN, to HBO, to Wall Street Journal, LA Times. It blew up overnight, and we literally spend nothing on advertising because there's so much out there about what we do that it is very difficult for us to keep up with the waves of people that are families that continue to reach us. And and I will say that, we're not just helping conservatives. We will help anybody anywhere. I have had a number of former Democrats, just got off the phone this morning with one from Newport Beach, who's saying, look, I can't even afford a home out here in Newport. It's costing him $4 a gallon to fill up. He'd like to move to another state where it's more tax friendly. And it just by nature, by default, those states tend to be conservative.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're running a business and it's real estate, so of course you're not going to say no to anyone, even if the core of what you're doing has to do with conservatives. Now, even though we're on opposite sides of the aisle politically, I got to say off the top, it's encouraging to hear that people are willing to move, at least in part for political reasons. That's exciting here in the clusterfuck world, that people will move. Now, are there any particular states where you're finding, you know, significantly more clients than others? I mean, obviously California is, you know, would be the natural, with so, you know, 38 million people and lots of disgruntled conservatives, I'm sure, and people think of Massachusetts and New York. Any other states where there's a lot of people that you're talking to?
So they're mostly moving from California, New York, New Jersey, Washington, Oregon, Illinois, specifically around Chicago area, and they're largely moving to three states. Number one, Texas. Number two, Idaho. Number three, Tennessee. And then the rest is evenly split out. You've got, you know, Florida, more of a purple state. You've got some Utah, Nevada being more purple now, Arizona kind of purplish. And then you have, you know, three really different kind of clientele that are moving. You have parents with young children who are not yet in high school, because what we have learned, and I think everybody knows, if you got a kid in high school, you're not moving. I don't care if the walls are coming down. Mm-hmm. You're not going to pull your kid out of high school. So it's largely middle-class families with young kids. The second segment are retirees, and the third are more long-term, where they are not yet retired, but they know they're on the horizon 2 or 3 years out. And so they're exploring options well ahead of time. They might be interested in buying land or even a home early and renting it out. And again, those three states starting off, Texas, Idaho, Tennessee, and then the others kind of fall in line after that.
Right. And you, and of course, you're in Texas, and obviously you started it just thinking about people moving there. So it's really become a national thing now. You're connecting with real estate agents and others, your suppliers or whoever, in a number of these states.
Yeah. And here's something fascinating that kind of took me by surprise. You know, Beto ran for U.S. Senate out here in 2018 against Ted Cruz. Beto, I think, you know, gosh, the guy can raise more money than most politicians combined. And mm-hmm. He brought in about $80 million, came real close to knocking off Ted Cruz out here in Texas. And that was a shock, I think, to a lot of people. But here's what was fascinating. There was an exit poll done of those voters. And the polling looked at, where are you, a native Texan or are you a transplant? And what the numbers showed, so almost by a 60-40 split, those that are moving to Texas are Republican and the remainder Democrat independents. The reason that was important, at least for our business model, is because there's a false assumption that everybody moving to Texas is a Democrat and they're coming with the companies. Certainly that's happening, but the exit polling is showing by a 60-40 split, more Republicans or more conservatives are moving here to Texas. I can't speak to the other states, but if Texas is any model to look at, that's pretty interesting, and I think it's worthy of further exploration.
Yeah, no, it actually, if the numbers are correct, that sort of goes against conventional wisdom because of course, you know, other than the fundraising and the grassroots enthusiasm, one of the reasons that people feel Beto did well is that the demographics are changing in Texas, that places like Austin and Houston and, you know, the liberal kind of areas, bigger cities are growing, you know, faster than other regions of the state. So, you know, that's interesting that the numbers may be showing something a little different there. And that's what I was going to ask you. I was thinking, you know, I know you're obviously doing your part to keep Texas red. But of course, in the political world, there's this feeling, you know, the Democrats can kind of taste it that, hey, we can finally win here at some point or it'll flip. I mean, Hillary's numbers were better than previous Democratic nominees for president. You know, she didn't come close to winning, but she moved the needle a little bit and she didn't even contest it. So I'm just wondering if your feeling is that maybe not just with those numbers you mentioned, but just in general, people are overrating the potential for Democrats to eventually, you know, win in Texas with some consistency.
No, I think that actually, I think the opposite. I think the Democrats could definitely win Texas mm-hmm. if the Republican Party remains complacent. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, a lot of us moving here from California have, I jokingly say, California PTSD. We saw our state go from Reagan, Nixon, Pete Wilson to a complete opposite within half of a lifetime, if you will. And so, you know, we're here in Texas looking at, you know, majority in the state house, every statewide elected office is Republican. But my message to the Republican Party is don't take that for granted. The Democrats are better funded. They're better organized. They're more motivated right now. And so, you know, as a Texan, certainly I want to keep Texas red, but I think from the Republicans looking at Texas, if they lose Texas, the Republicans will never hold the White House again. I mean, the state is that important, I think, to both parties. If the Democrats can pull Texas away, Republicans are done. Republicans are never going to get a California-size electoral college, you know, numbers coming in, and Texas is, you know, the closest you're going to get. And if the Democrats, you know, hold California as they will, hold New York as they will, and pick up Texas down the road, the White House is far removed from our party ever holding it again.
Right, and that's why it's so tantalizing for Democrats. And if you keep pulling away those Republicans and conservatives from the other states you mentioned, yeah, the Democrats won't have anything to worry about there. But, you know, on this show, as you know, we try to encourage liberals to move where they don't already live, because the idea is, you know, liberals are clustering in some of the places we've been talking about and not spread out far enough across the country, given the electoral system in the U.S. But the other part of it, that's the literal clustering. I also talk a lot about figurative clustering. Not going to speak for your side of the aisle, but on our side, you know, liberals sometimes tend to get into this bubble where they're just talking to other liberals, you know, just talking to people who already agree with them. And, you know, Trump won the election because Democrats, you know, arguably didn't reach out to some of these other folks who they could have a conversation with, like you kind of said at the top, respectful conversation. They may not agree on everything, but you've got to keep the dialogue going. So that's sort of the theme of what we try to talk about here. On the theme of your company, though, is basically saying to conservatives, don't bother having those conversations. Just get out of there.
That is a general feeling, if you will, of those that we talk to on the phone. It's such a sense of, I don't mean to be over dramatic, but it's just, they're so frustrated. They feel like they've just given up, like they cannot take it anymore. And look, most of these are pocketbook issues, but the pocketbook issues are driven by Democrat policies for the most part. So, you know, California is a really good example of this, where the gas tax, and you know, look, the electorate had a fair chance to repeal that, and they did not in this last cycle. So, and now, you know, they're coming after potentially Prop 13 in California, which protects your property values and kind of helps limit those from rising. Well, in 2020 now will be on the ballot in California is to remove Prop 13 protection from businesses. And then the theory is, well, then they'll go to 2022 to potentially remove that from homeowners. And I think they could get away with that in California because you have more of a renter market in California than a homeowner market. And if you've got more renters looking at it, and the Democrats are real good at the ballot propositions and putting a simple ballot proposition up there saying, hey, we need more money for schools, we need to reduce or eliminate Prop 13, electorate, what do you say? I think they could get that passed in California. I think that would also squeeze out, you know, more homeowners to consider leaving, but we shall see.
Well, I know, you know, obviously you run a real estate company, so certainly the economics play into it. But is that your take, that a number of these conservatives, your clients who are coming to these red states, their disagreements with Democrats are largely on the economic side rather than, say, social issues or that sort of thing? That's kind of where it's coming from?
There is a social aspect, but I still think everything is bread and butter around the dining room table issues of finance. Mm-hmm. I think everybody worries about their financial future. If you look at the new SALT deductions, the cap, if you will, that was passed by Congress, you're seeing clients. New Wall Street Journal article talked about wealthy folks leaving New York right now and moving to Miami, a much different tax structure in Miami, and that SALT deduction largely hurts Democrat states where they have a state income tax, higher property taxes, because you can only write off so much right now. So certainly, I think, you know, financially savvy people will look at that and say, look, if it's not for friends, family, weather, why am I sticking around? Mm-hmm. Obviously, those three do keep most people, I think, anchored to where they are. But there are social issues. The last, I think, 8-9 days, ever since New York, Cuomo and the Democrats signed off on that new abortion bill, mm-hmm. That infuriated a lot of Republican New Yorkers. And so on our website, it'd be fascinating to kind of publish all the comments someday, but when people go to our website, conservativemove.com, you know, there's an opportunity there to, we basically say, tell us more information, what else would you like us to know? Well, some of clients, future clients, literally will just write, you know, paragraph after paragraph after paragraph. So the last 8 or 9 days, when we just micro-target and look at New York and the reasons why they're moving, certainly may have been financial, but this abortion bill might have been the final nail in the coffin, and that's what's pushing them to want to leave now. They just feel so grotesque by what's happening, they don't want to be in the state anymore.
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't want to dive too deep into the weeds on abortion, but I feel like that's one of those issues where, I mean, I'm, you know, being liberal, I'm pro-choice, but I recognize, you know, I understand why people are pro-life, and I think it's a perfectly fine position to have. And I feel like there's some dishonesty sort of on both sides of it. Like, you know, the pro-lifers are, you know, kind of obsessed with painting Democrats as wanting to kill babies. And on the other side, we have, you know, the liberals going sort of out of control and saying that Republicans and conservatives want to control women's bodies. And, you know, if you really actually dive into why people believe, you know, why someone's pro-life, well, they look at it as it is a life. And it's coming very much from that perspective. And, you know, I feel like on the pro-choice side, it's people who, they're not, you know, they're not interested in seeing people have third trimester abortions. They're interested in people who are in certain situations where, you know, having a child, you know, it's an unplanned pregnancy, it's an unwanted pregnancy, whatever the scenario is, that people have an option and the government isn't forcing them to carry all the pregnancies to term. So I feel like, you know, if there was ever a chance to just have more of an honest dialogue between the two sides of the aisle, you know, rather than the loudest voices, you know, being so overdramatic, we might find some common ground there.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I don't know. I think there's certain issues that are just going to remain polarizing. It's abortion, you know, the death penalty, immigration. I mean, hoping for the best. Yeah, I will say that growing up in college, you know, again, I voted for Ross Perot. I evolved into a Republican. And I remember being asked early, you know, whether I was pro-choice or pro, you know, whatever it was, the verbiage they were using back then in the 90s. And, you know, I was like, oh, you know what, who am I to tell a woman what to do with her body?
Right.
And that's kind of how I just left it. But how I changed on that was I became a dad. I was there for the 4 births. I saw the ultrasound. Everything for me just turned a complete 180. And so now I advocate everything we can, you know, for adoption and all those pieces that I think we should be talking more about. We do so much it's so hard to adopt here in the States. We've got families that are flying to Russia and other countries to adopt babies. And yet here in America, we've, I think, had 60, what is it? It's a huge number, 60 million abortions since Roe v. Wade. And I look at all the parents out here that would love to adopt, and yet they're going to other countries to make that happen. And why are we not putting that front and center?
Yep. No, I agree. I mean, I think both sides would like to see a reduction in abortions, and it's just, you know, it's in how that's accomplished. And, you know, I find on the conservative side there's pushback on everything from sex ed to, you know, say, same-sex couples adopting and all this. And so it's like sometimes it feels like if we could meet halfway here, okay, you know, you want to, you know, change some of the abortion laws, well, then what else can we do that's, you know, that's in this century to reduce the number of unwanted pregnancies in the first place. But, you know, I hear what you're saying. And it's funny, when I became a dad, actually, I ended up being more pro-choice. I would have predicted going in your direction to some degree, but knowing all that happens in a pregnancy and all the stress and health-related things, and just thinking that if a government would force a woman to do this, like that, you have to go through this no matter what. That's the part that made me even more uneasy. But anyway, I didn't want to, you know, dive too deep into the, you know, Paul and Roger debate abortion. I did want to say, though, I wonder, like, did you ever vote Democrat? Is there, you know?
Great question. So
yeah.
I worked for President Clinton in the White House. I was a presidential management intern. Now it's called presidential management fellow.
An intern for Clinton. There could be jokes, but I'll leave it. You know.
No, I didn't get that close to him. So I graduated USC and applied to be a presidential management fellow. Was offered a job in D.C. at the White House, working in the Clinton administration, doing drug policy, law enforcement programs. And I will say, back then, you know, certainly there were always issues, but it just seemed like we got along much better. There was much more agreement. I remember Clinton advocating, and Congress agreed on the welfare to work program, putting 100,000 more cops on the street. I mean, yeah, the impeachment really was a foundational shake between the Republicans and Democrats at that time. But I think today we're just so far apart. But I also will tell you that I think a reason we're so far apart is because we've gotten nastier, in a sense, and that has come from our social media use. I see on Facebook, it is a one-dimensional platform where people wouldn't necessarily say to your face the same things they write, but because so many people spend so much time only on Facebook, that it has sort of become their new personality, and I really feel that has been a huge detriment to any kind of civil debate on topics, because it's just not happening
anymore. No, I know. And it's, I mean, and, you know, Facebook, not so much, but on Twitter and some of the others, you know, you can be anonymous. And there isn't, you know, I think it's some of the things we've both been saying in this conversation. There just isn't enough people saying, hey, let's talk about these things. Let's really understand what the other person is saying. I don't mean it's kind of a kumbaya thing. I don't want to sound, you know, corny here, but it's like, let's, you know, as soon as someone says something that's supposedly offensive or, critical in any way, they get jumped on rather than having a chance to explain themselves, clarify, you know, that sort of thing. It's that mentality. And you're right. It just gets amped up on social media. And it's, of course, it's the other thing that we talk about on this podcast, that clustering where, you know, you can set your life up on social media and your entire life really to be only around people who already agree with you. And it's just the echo chamber. So, you know, we've got to watch that, I think. But, it's encouraging to me that people are willing to move, as I said before. And, your company seems to be doing well. And I do wish you luck. And even for sort of selfish partisan reasons, because as I said earlier, you know, you might help guarantee that a number of key states stay blue if you're getting enough people down there.
You're right. I mean, you know, California is going to stay blue, New York, New Jersey. Here's the interesting long-term aspect is California, Illinois, and New York may each lose congressional seats. Mm-hmm. Those pickups could go to the red states, California, Florida, and a few others. But look, the populations are so dense in those blue states that, you know, even losing one seat here and there isn't going to make an impact. You shouldn't count out Florida. Gosh, I should have learned that lesson.
Oh, no. No, I know. Florida, I saw a tweet recently, something about if Florida was voting on between having ice cream or getting kicked in the head, it would still be 50-49. just before we wrap up, I asked if you'd voted Democrat, but I just curious, you and your clients and everything, are there things you think the Democratic Party could do to eventually maybe get, you know, some of your votes, certain issues where you do see the potential for common ground?
I do, and this is what I've long said. I think the Democrat Party has moved away from the working middle class, and that's a large segment that Trump picked up, especially in the Midwest. I mean, if I could give any advice to the Democrat Party, if they wanted to grow, it would be to, you know, push away from the extreme ends of the socialism aspect, which is becoming a little bit more prominent beyond just Bernie. Mm-hmm. And the Democrat Party used to represent the blue dog, you know, workers, the steel mills where all my grandfathers worked outside of Turtle Creek. You know, these were all World War II vet Democrats. But today, I think if they were still alive, they would be Republicans. And so I think the Democrat could broaden their tent by getting back to the bread and butter issues of the working class, because that's who we see moving. It's the middle class. In California, you largely have two classes of people left, your coastal kind of liberal elite or your inland working poor, and the middle class keeps fleeing. And so if I were Democrat strategist trying to grow, I would look at that middle class and see what they could do to be more attractable.
Absolutely. No, I get that. And I mean, it's sort of strange with the party because, yes, you know, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and some of the other sort of more outspoken far left leaders get a lot of attention. But they also just won the midterms, you know, took 40 seats by running relatively moderate candidates in largely suburban districts that used to be Republican. So it's sort of this battle going on, you know, within the party of which direction they want to go. And they, you know, they straddle the line reasonably well, but we'll see what happens with, you know, during the primaries and who they end up nominating and all that stuff.
Yeah, I will say I've always liked Bernie for one reason. He's honest.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? You got to respect whether you disagree, agree. I've always respected his direct honesty on his opinion, on his values. And so that is where I think we all need to begin, is coming from our positions of honesty. At least we can respect that and move forward in chatting.
Absolutely. Let's end on that note. I appreciate you coming on the podcast, and I do wish you luck with Conservative Move. Sounds like it's going great. That's conservativemove.com if you want to check it out. Paul Chabot, thanks for joining us, and I appreciate the civil discussion.
You bet, Roger. I'm looking forward to it again. Have a great rest of your day.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
And there's Paul Chabot from conservativemove.com, getting conservatives out of blue states, which should help to make them even bluer than they already are. So we thank Paul for his fine work, and I do appreciate him joining me here on Clusterfucked. To find out more about this podcast and, of course, listen to other episodes, the place to go is cfthepodcast.com. That's cfthepodcast.com. And as I usually mention at the end of the episodes, we do have a place you can support the podcast there. I don't have any big backer, financial backer, or major advertiser. No one's footing the bill for some of our expenses. We are recording at the very fine studio, dbaudio.ca, and we've got website hosting and web design and some marketing stuff and a few other little expenses. And if you do like what you hear here at Clusterfucked Headquarters, then we do appreciate your support. There's a button there on the website, cfthepodcast.com. Also, we have the mailing list. Please join. We like to update on episodes and only things related to the Clusterfucked community. You will not be bombarded by advertisements or anything else nefarious in your inbox, only official correspondence from Clusterfucked Headquarters. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, my name on there is The Civil Liberal, but the handle is at CF The Podcast. That's at CF The Podcast. Again, really appreciate you taking the time to listen.
The Clusterfucked Podcast, a liberal host with red state guests.
I'm Roger King. That'll be all.